listening to the podcast of the musictherapyresearchblog.com. This week's episode of the Music Therapy Research Podcast, Blythe and I were very pleased to speak with Dr. Kenneth Agin, a colleague and friend and a wonderful music therapist whose clinical specialties include work with children and adolescents with emotional and developmental delays and adults and mental health. His research uses musicological analyses to reveal connections between the elements of music and common cognitive, emotional, and physical goals in music therapy. He lectures internationally and has authored numerous publications on Nordoff Robbins music therapy, popular music and music therapy, and qualitative research methodology. Two of his books, Paths of Development in Nordoff Robbins Music Therapy and Music-Centered Music Therapy, which came out in 2005, have been translated into Japanese and Korean. Ken is a past president of the American Association for Music Therapy, a recipient of the Research and Publication Awards from the American Music Therapy Association, and he was the scientific committee chairman for the 9th World Congress of Music Therapy. His most recent book is The Study of Music Therapy, Core Issues and Concepts, which was published by Routledge in December 2013. Agin received his doctorate from New York University in 1991, and for 15 years he was the research director and then co-director of the Nordoff Robbins Center for Music Therapy at NYU from 2006 until returning to Steinhardt School of Music in 2013. Ken Agin was an associate professor in music therapy at Temple University, where he received the Lindbach Award for Distinguished Teaching. Now Ken joins us for this episode of the podcast from New York University, where he's currently teaching, and we hope you really enjoy this conversation that's part of our editorial board for the Journal of Music Therapy series for the Music Therapy Research Podcast. So pleased to be talking again with Dr. Ken Agin today on the Music Therapy Research Blog. And if you wouldn't mind starting, Ken, with your pathway to becoming interested in music therapy research, where do you first remember hearing about research or actually thinking this is an area of music therapy that you really wanted to be more engaged in?
Well, I think I have to go pretty far back to answer that question completely. I mean, not too far back, at least to my undergraduate studies. Unlike a lot of music therapists, I really didn't study music formally. I had a double major in psychology and philosophy, and it was primarily experimental psychology, or what was called cognitive psychology back in the 70s. And my interests in philosophy were in the history and philosophy of science. So I always had this underlying interest in the conduct of science and of research in general. And then, you know, after graduating with an undergraduate psychology and philosophy degree, I did the most logical thing. I joined a rock band for 2 years, because what else can you do with an undergraduate degree and double major in psychology and philosophy? Mm-hmm. But luckily, you know, I banged around playing music for a few years, and then I discovered music therapy and started my music therapy study when I was about 25. But I'd already had this solid background, like I said, in experimental psychology and philosophy of science. So I came to music therapy with a predisposition to be interested in activities like research.
And was that research, and so when you're talking about experimental research in psychology courses and everything, am I right in thinking, what university, what is this? I mean, is this like a 300, 400 level class that just sort of caught your eye that you were, you know, you had these guys talking about their studies with rats, or the, you know, you're cued in talking about the famous, you know, Stanford studies and Milgram and all these, all these sort of traditional research things that are brought up in psychology courses?
Well, I was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, whose claim to fame was Harry Harlow and his primate research. I don't know if in my introductory psychology book, we had some photographs, and he was the guy that would take infant chimps, I don't know if they were chimpanzees, I think they were, from their mothers at birth, just to study what happened to infant animal primates that were isolated from any maternal care and concern. And I thought it was pretty brutal. I actually applied for a job in the lab and spent half a day there and just was devastated emotionally. I felt it was kind of, not kind of, it was very unethical what was going on there. Mm-hmm. And, but what it meant was my education, I had a very strong background in experimental psych in terms of, you know, all different kinds of design, a couple of statistics courses. The content area I was interested in, however, was related to like theories of mind, information processing, theories of cognition and perception. And in fact, my interests sort of overlapped philosophy and psychology, which is, you know, my interests weren't particularly clinical. They weren't behavioral. They were really about interesting questions about theory of mind and that kind of thing. But the degree itself, like I said, was highly experimental in that sense.
So did you continue then when you went into studying music therapy? How did that research interest continue as you went through those studies?
Well, it was interesting. The first year of my study at NYU, there was a very famous symposium in 1982 with the the overly gender-specific title called Music in the Life of Man. I say there would never be a title like that today, but this was about 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. And at that symposium, there were music therapists and music theorists from all over the world coming to NYU, meeting in these small work groups. And as a master's student, one of us was asked to attend each work group and act as sort of a scribe, a transcriber. What we did was just audio record the talks, as well as take notes during the session. And we would then spend the evening typing up the notes so that the group could get them and review them the next day and use them to further their deliberations. So I was in the research group, and actually there's a book coming out on this topic very shortly, edited, I think written by Carolyn Kenny and Michelle Fornash. There's a book coming out on the symposium. But I was in the research group even then. And I think, I'm trying to remember who was there. Cliff Madsen was in the research group. Evan Rude from Norway. Mm-hmm. A couple of other music therapists from Germany, Scandinavia. Charles Eagle was there. So, you know, right away from my very beginning as a music therapy student, I got exposed to these music therapy pioneers and people who were very interested in music therapy research.
And you were aware that they were all kind of these pioneering, you were aware that, you know, because I know when I was a student, that I'm following along the people who wrote all my books and the people whose articles I'm reading in the, you know, in the journals and everything. And you were aware, you know, like you knew who Cliff Madsen was and Claim to Fame. And
sure. I mean, again, we were at NYU, the training there is more music psychotherapeutic. So we weren't reading a whole lot of Cliff's work. I think we read something by Charles. Although, you know, the field, there just weren't that many publications back then. So, you know, the famous Gaston text was one of our main texts in my intro music therapy course.
Sure.
So, you know, we knew, even though it was a back then, excuse me, an AAMT school, we were cognizant of people from all over the spectrum as well as people from Europe. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I graduated from NYU in 1984, and I didn't think too much about research during my master's degree or immediately after. And I think what motivated my interest in research was just getting the journals, even the white journal in music therapy, the AAMT journal, and just being really disappointed with what I was reading, feeling like nothing that I read seemed to really relate very much to my work as a music therapist. So, you know, I sort of became a critic of the existing work. And what happens when you start criticizing things, people say, well, you think you can do any better, you know? It's like you open your big mouth, you got to contribute and do something. So then what happened was I knew that I wanted to pursue a career in secondary ed. I wanted to, you know, become college faculty eventually. And so at that point, NYU started a doctoral program. I think this was like 1987. And so coming back to NYU 3 years or 4 years after graduating, now for doctoral study, and the whole focus of the doctoral work was research. So that kind of, that's where I started really getting much more interested in research, was through, you know, coming back for doctoral study.
And what did you ended up, what did you end up starting with in terms of your initial research interests, and what did you want to start writing about?
Well, again, my whole motivation for becoming a researcher was to do things that I felt were relevant to working clinicians and that related to actual work with clients. And so what we discovered was this whole tradition of qualitative research, which in its methodological flexibility seemed much more congruent in philosophically with the precepts of creative music therapy practice and music psychotherapeutic practice. So the entire degree at NYU was built on qualitative research. I think all of the studies, except maybe one, were done from qualitative framework. And really, the more important commitment was to clinically relevant research. So the commitment to qualitative research was a secondary consequence, I'd say, of looking for a research approach that would be relevant clinically, that would help us learn about clinical work, that would allow us to study clinical work as it proceeded naturalistically without having to be altered to meet any experimental protocols. So, you know, coming from this quantitative experimental psychology background, I felt like my embracing of the qualitative approach wasn't, you know, a reflexive rejection of anything to do with numbers. Although I will admit I did fail psychometrics the first time I took it. I had to retake it.
It's not a short list of music therapy majors that struggled with any sort of statistics. I'm sure of that.
But, I mean, I kind of felt that my interest in qualitative research was as a solution to a problem, not just sort of a preconception or sort of a, you know, a knee-jerk reaction against anything involving numbers. So that's what drew me to the qualitative approach.
That's all really interesting to hear about your history and how you came into music therapy research. Could you tell us now a little bit about your current research interests?
Okay, as you guys know, I've had a little bit of a career that's moved around a little bit. I worked at the Nordoff Robbins Center for 15 years, first as director of research and then as co-director. So basically all of my work was, all my empirical research was focused on the Nordoff Robbins work. And then I went to Temple University for 7 years, and now I've been back at NYU for two. And I have to say, I was just thinking about this the other day. I don't think we have the luxury in music therapy to have compartmentalized roles. Although I know that in physics, you know, there are theoretical physicists and experimental physicists. And I think I've always been a little more comfortable on the theory and the conceptual end of things, looking at broad themes, looking at broad paradigmatic shifts and that type of thing. So I'm always torn between just getting down with nuts and bolts research projects and looking at broader types of theoretical and foundational research. So I think in the last number of years, maybe 5 or 6, I've been a little more drawn to the theoretical conceptual end. And I think, you know, to be honest, I guess we're, you know, as a person, I've just felt more drawn to a great variety of topics than to picking one topic and one line of research and taking it far. So if I reflect on my own work, I see lots of studies in different areas rather than sort of one line of research, which I think is the more traditional trajectory for a researcher. Having said that, I'd have to identify two current interests. One I started and I haven't done a whole lot with, but I want to return to, is exemplified in an article I published in Journal of Music Therapy a few years ago, where I took some compositions, a composition written for therapy and a music therapy improvisation, and did a very detailed musical analysis in order to show the connection between the therapist's musical, specific musical choices and clinical intention. So, for example, I look at harmonic components, direction of melody, skips and leaps in melody when a therapist is improvising at the piano. And in this particular example, the therapist was working with a client who had a very bad neurological injury and had lost the ability to talk or move and was gradually recovering those abilities. So it was more like a rehabilitation context. And I talked about how the management of the vertical relations and tonal space that were being done by the therapist were a reflection of facilitating the client's movement, vertical movement in actual physical space, right? So it was looking at the management of musical space and physical space and how that's integrated in clinical improvisation. In this case, a Nordoff Robbins example. So I'd have to say that's still a very strong interest of mine, looking really at detailed musical analyses and trying to draw the connections to clinical intent. Because, you know, as I've said before, I think until music therapists can really make those connections, we're really operating at the level of folk healers in the sense that, you know, a folk healer knows that a particular plant might help a particular condition, but can't tell you why. And so in my view, therapists pragmatically and intuitively learn how to use the elements of music clinically. But until we can actually make a direct explanatory connection between those choices and clinical outcome, we're kind of akin to the folk healer. And then I'd say my other interest, and in fact, what I've been spending the last couple of weeks on and the next couple of weeks and the rest of today when we're done with our talk, is really looking at what's going on in the autism community today. And looking at concepts such as neurodiversity, self-advocacy, and empowerment, and understanding how we can start enacting research projects in music therapy that are not only reflective of these more contemporary progressive beliefs, but that can actually proceed hand in hand with autistic people, trying to find ways to incorporate people with autism, not just as participants, not just having a voice, but actually as co-researchers. And, you know, I don't have to tell you, Blythe, about this because I know how intimately you're involved with this work as well. And it's something, I guess it's something I'm kind of new to, although if I look back at some of my previous research with autistic people, I can see the seeds of this kind of interest in a few of those projects. Just in the way that I would try to give the participants a strong voice in the research, represent them in my writings, how I would analyze the musical capacities of autistic people, trying to discern the underlying cognitive operations that were present and saying, listen, just because someone can't communicate verbally doesn't mean they don't communicate musically. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, using the musical expression of autistic people to make somewhat of an interpretation about what might be going on cognitively. I wanted to get away from the idea we so much identify cognition with verbal skill, and I've always been invested in trying to use people's musicking and musical relationships as a way to understand them better. So I guess those are my two interests at the current time.
And I just want to pivot from you as a researcher to you as somebody who's and the way that you talk about research or discuss research with students and then, you know, with and beyond as we pivot to that part of the discussion. But I think it's interesting that, you know, you start explaining your background of philosophy and psychology, and you can see that in any researcher that, you know, there are these threads that keep on building as researchers gain experience and how our research, you know, changes. There's a certain kind of evolution to the researcher, both in thought and then also the way, you know, that we conduct our methodologies, the way that we end up writing and everything. I'm wondering, do you use these personal experiences very specifically when you're trying to communicate research to your students when you were at Temple and now at NYU? How do you talk to students? How do you get them interested in wanting to be part of the research debate?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, when I was at Temple, I came into a very vibrant research culture. I mean, there was a bachelor's, master's, and doctoral program. Ken Brucia and Cheryl DeLeo were the faculty there, and Darlene Brooks, all of whom have, you know, so influential in music therapy research. So students were coming there, especially at the master's and doctoral level, because they wanted research. So they didn't have to be motivated or interested at all, really. In terms of now my current work, you know, NYU is a master's program, but it's been purely a clinical program until now. And I've now introduced the first required research course into the curriculum. So, you know, I'm very proud of that. I think one of the things I try to do is illustrate how doing research has a lot of different purposes and needs. And certainly there are the pragmatic reasons to do research, such as ensuring greater access to services for clients. And there are also internal needs to help us understand what we do as music therapists better. So I think the way I try to interest students is to let them know that there's a really wide spectrum of research practices, research motivations, research interests, that doing research can be one path of self-development and self-knowledge, that doing research can be also feed into one's clinical work, that it doesn't have to be something apart from it. So I try to, I think, disavow the notion that all research is just undertaken by a man or a woman in a white coat in a very sterile laboratory setting, you know, writing about things that don't affect anything in the real world. I think I try to root all of my talk about research in people's more concrete concerns about their clinical practice.
That's great that you have a research class and that you're able to influence and hopefully excite students in future research. And I appreciate the work that you're doing in autism. And also want to say that I appreciate what you brought to the Research 2025 discussion about creative music therapy and how really looking at what music is doing and how we're using this craft in order to help individuals. A different perspective from my own, but I really do appreciate some of your views on that. And I'm wondering if I can ask you a two-parter here, if you would kind of recap some of what you were saying at the Research 2025 event, since many people weren't there, just about creative music therapy and how we look at that. And then along with that, what you would tell new researchers who are wanting to go and study music and therapy.
Well, you know, music therapy really straddles the domain of the arts and of healthcare, and I'm not the first person nor the last who would observe that. And, you know, music really exists in human culture because of the inherent gratification it provides. And it's this gratification that motivates all of us to be musicians, that motivates musicians to devote their lifetimes to playing and mastering it. And it's also this inherent gratification that I think motivates clients to participate in music. But there's this real paradox in our work, because generally we tend to explain our work as the use of music to achieve non-musical goals. And in that way, we're sort of denying the inherent gratification aspect of music. However, if music therapy is the use of music to achieve non-musical goals, then if there's a better way of achieving that non-musical goal, whatever it is, we'd be obligated to abandon music therapy. And so I think a lot of us music therapists would take pause at that and say, well, no, I think underneath a lot of our belief systems is the idea that in addition to all the secondary benefits in cognition, motor functioning, affect, social functioning, there's just something inherently gratifying to music that we would not want to do without. And so this conventional view, and what I call the intrinsic gratification view, they each offer something while leaving a specific problem. The conventional view kind of helps music therapy fit into standard structures and concepts of therapy. but it leaves us having to justify why music therapy is superior to other treatment options. Because, you know, I can't help but thinking, if we're using music therapy to help speech, you know, are we really going to be better than speech therapists? If we're using music therapy to help motor function, are we really going to be better than physical and occupational therapists of that? If we're using music therapy to resolve emotional conflicts, are we really going to be better than verbal psychotherapists at that? So it kind of leaves us with an almost like an existential problem, a justification view. So what I was talking about at the music therapy research gathering is that we really have to find a way to honor both of these views, because what I call the intrinsic gratification view will help music therapy survive because it ensures that there will always be something unique that we do and provide. However, the conventional view helps us fit into social structures and healthcare systems and that type of thing. So I think that what the solution is really to be cognizant of both. In fact, I was just talking with some students about this yesterday. And we talked about our musical goals, legitimate clinical goals to have. And then I said, well, what if, you know, your client wants to come in, you're working with an at-risk adolescent, inner city, and the group of boys, and they just want to record a rap CD. They want to write some songs, record it, have the CD, play it for the family, have a CD release party. You know, or the traditional view in music therapy has been, oh, well, you know, the desire to make some music just gets the people in the door, and that's the motivation. But that's not really how we're going to explain what it works. And to me, that view has always been a little bit condescending towards clients. And I've always been more of the view that we should take the client's needs and agenda seriously in creating our rationale for treatment. So, you know, it might be that when we're working with clients, we can adopt their framework. This is about making music. Now, it's also true that there's going to be all kinds of secondary benefits. These kids working on a CD together are going to show social skills, impulse control, focusing abilities, all those things. So perhaps for an administrative bureaucracy, we can talk about what we're doing in those terms. However, I think as music therapists, we need to realize those are secondary benefits, and we can explain our work along those lines for pragmatic reasons, but we shouldn't merge with those reasons. In other words, if we're adopting them really for pragmatic purposes, we shouldn't forget what's really going on is that we're providing musical experiences for people who can't create them on their own, and we're providing these experiences because they will have an inherently gratifying and beneficial effect on the people's lives. And so I think, you know, whether we're doing research, clinical practice, theorizing, if we really honor and respect clients, we have to sort of take their perspective into view in explaining our rationale and in designing research studies.
I think it was interesting that just in that last sentence where you were sort of describing what some people are would call the tripod of research and clinical practice and theory, and making sure we have equal parts of all of them. I'm wondering, is that something that how do you translate all those three when you're giving advice to new researchers in music therapy? So you've got, let's say there's just some new clinicians that are out there, they're doing the clinical work and they're thinking, I do want to do research. I loved reading journals when I had the research class at university. And right now but how do I even get into it without having my PhD or without, you know, my doctoral degree of some kind and some, you know, significant master's experience in that way? What's your advice for new researchers in the field?
Yeah, that's it's a little bit of a tough one, because I think you can do informal program evaluation kinds of things that use procedures of research without maybe meeting formal criteria for a publishable research study. And so I think, you know, telling people, hey, interview the parents of your clients. That's one way. Well, interview the recipients of your services. Find out from them if they're capable of, you know, that sort of verbal interaction, what music therapy is like for them, what works for them, what their experience of it is. And so, you know, I always tell students, go back to your experience as clinicians. If you want to create clinically relevant research, don't start necessarily from an idea or a theory or a pragmatic purpose, but start from what happens in the real world in your interactions with people. You know, look at your session notes and highlight, look for patterns in them. In other words, you know, start with whatever your representation of the clinical work is. I have to say, you know, when people without research training want to do research, typically it's because of pressure at a work site. You know, my board of directors wants some numbers. The executive director wants a satisfaction survey. And I think actually that's something I'm not so experienced in and not all that good at. And I think there's a real need in our field for training of what I'd say is almost quasi-research, maybe informal program evaluation that people could undertake without extensive research experience. And like I say, it may not be publishable in a peer-reviewed journal, but that doesn't mean that it isn't worth doing, because people, those folks you were mentioning, I think often have other reasons for wanting to do research other than peer review publication, you know, towards securing tenure at an academic position. So Maybe that's something as a profession we could do a little bit of a better job at. Unfortunately, it's just not an area of my expertise.
And it's a, it brings me back to my beginning as a researcher too. I just started a new job and I didn't have any idea if the other clinicians working at this facility even knew what music therapy was or what I was doing there and why they hired me in the first place. So I did a little bit of program evaluation and to be honest, we're trained in, you know, assessment, treatment and evaluation. Why not be able to sort of turn that on ourselves and be able to look at our own practice and see how that works as research design almost. So yeah, I think that's an interesting point and good advice for new researchers. And I'd like to thank you for your time today. Thanks very much for joining myself and Blythe for this podcast and for discussing research with us. Much appreciated.
Music for this podcast was "The Sidewalks of New York" by Matt LeGrew. This has been the Music Therapy Research Podcast, associated with musictherapyresearchblog.com. Your hosts are Dr. Blythe Lagasse and Dr. Andrew Knight, music therapy faculty members at Colorado State University. Follow MTRB on Facebook and your hosts on Twitter to stay up on all the music therapy research we send out into the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please let us know by heading to iTunes and submitting a review and a rating. It only takes a minute and helps our visibility on the iTunes page tremendously. Thanks in advance. Also, send in a comment about the podcast on the contact page at musictherapyresearchblog.com.